soldier, a marine, a coast guardsman, a sailor, and a naval lieutenant. The casket had been placed on the east side of the east room, and some 250 small gold gilt chairs, arranged in semicircles, faced the casket. A few larger chairs were in the front row. The center aisle, from the great hall of the White House to the casket, was carpeted in red. Only the hum of the air conditioning machinery was to be heard in an otherwise silent room. In spite of the fact that Mrs. Roosevelt had asked that flowers not be sent, the four walls of the great east room were completely banked with calla lilies, carnations, roses, snapdragons, and other spring flowers, rising in bouquets and baskets as high as 8 and 10 feet, higher than the candelabra on the mantle of the great mirrors, overriding the bases of the portraits of George and Martha Washington. The great red drapes were open. It had started to rain outside, so not much light came through, but the three magnificent old chandeliers put forth the light on the casket of Franklin D. Roosevelt. The crowd, the friends and relatives of the president, continued to come in. Ray Henley will tell you of them.
I think that the thing that struck Carlton Smith and me most of all, probably, was the utter simplicity of the services this afternoon. There was no choir, there were no swelling strains from any military band, even though, of course, the president, both dead and present, could have commanded the finest music in the world. There was only the music only came from a piano, just one piano, with a lady playing, I didn't get her name, a lady playing the piano, the hymns, as we went along through the services. Really, it would have reminded you, I believe, of a simple ceremony, simple funeral service in your own home. It was that simple. When we entered the East Room, the first person that I noticed, and I don't think you'll find this strange because of his distinguished appearance, was the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Mr. Charles Evans Hughes, with his white beard and his fine white hair and his ruddy complexion. And then I saw beside him, of course, the other members of the court, that is the present active members of the court. Justice Hughes is now retired. And sitting at the head of that line was the present Chief Justice of the United States, Mr. Harlan Fiske Stone. And then along with him were the other members of the court. And then came behind him were sitting the cabinet. I noticed that the Secretary of War, Mr. Stimson, sat on the aisle seat, not the Secretary of State, Petunias, who is the ranking member of the cabinet. He was farther in. Mr. Stimson was on the aisle seat. He may have come in later. He probably did come in later, since there were a number of people in the room by the time we had entered. And then some way back in the semicircle, the guests that were at the services were arranged in a semicircle divided by a center aisle at the head of which the casket stood. And then farther back was Governor Thomas E. Dewey of New York. The governor had come down for the services. He sat in one of the rows about middle back, dressed in a dark blue suit, rather dark gray tie. I noticed that Stephen Early, the president's secretary, one of the president's secretary and his close friend and confidant, left his own seat and went around and shook hands with Governor Dewey. Sitting next to Governor Dewey was the governor's friend, John Foster Dulles. I thought that was an especially interesting note to these services, since it brought together in a very unique and, you might say, a very democratic, typically American way, the two men who had fought it out in the last campaign. And then behind Father in the rear, there were such dignitaries as Fleet Admiral Leahy, the president's personal chief of staff, And we saw Admiral McIntyre, the president's doctor. Also, General of the Army, George Marshall, and Mrs. Marshall. And incidentally, as I go along and name some of these officials, with many of them, their wives were present, seated with them. And also, Fleet Admiral and Mrs. Ernest J. King. Admiral King looked straight ahead, neither left nor right. He spoke no word to either Mrs. King on one side of him or the guest who was sitting on the other side of him. A little farther on was Crown Princess Martha of Norway, who you know is making her home here now in Washington. And then as we sat watching in this quiet, quiet room, the most noticeable thing about this to me was the utter quiet of this room. And as we sat there in this room with scarcely a stir from anyone even moving on these gilt chairs that we were sitting on, and they're rather fragile and frail chairs and should squeak a little if people move, but there wasn't a single sound. And as we sat there, then entered a large delegation representing Congress, the Senate and the House, led by Speaker Rayburn and Senator Barkley and others. I noticed Senator Saltonstall of Massachusetts, Senator Ball of Minnesota, Mrs. Edith North Rogers, and many other congressional figures. Then on the right-hand side, to the right of the casket, the diplomatic corps was seated. I believe that the entire diplomatic corps was present, the heads of all of the various missions represented here in Washington. And conspicuous among them, of course, was the Russian ambassador, Mr. Gromyko. I noticed also sitting up in front the Earl of Athlone, who's the Governor General of Canada. And just after Carlton Smith and I entered, Anthony Eden, the British Foreign Secretary, walked in. He was carrying his black Homburg in his hand. He had on formal day clothes, although a short coat with his striped trousers. And Mr. Eden walked briskly to the section reserved for the diplomatic corps and took his seat in front of them, along by the Earl of Athlone. We also noticed as we walked in such figures as Bernard Baruch, the distinguished-looking Mr. Baruch, who has been a confidant of many presidents and who now has seen two war presidents go down in death because of their burdens. He was a confidant of Mr. Wilson and also of Franklin Roosevelt. Then I think that one of the interesting things about the congregation, you might say, was the fact that the entire personal staff, the president's entire personal staff, which has been with him for many years, were given a special place of honor in this room, and I'm told that they also will go on the funeral train tonight and attend the ceremonies at Hyde Park, services at Hyde Park tomorrow morning. There are such people as, I don't know whether you recognize these names or not. These are people who served the president well and long. They served anonymously, but they are very important to the smooth running of the White House under any president. People like Miss Hackmeister, the telephone operator. Miss Grace Tully is the president's personal secretary, and George Fox, the White House pharmacist. And then Roberta Barrows and Dorothy Brady and Joy Batchelder of the stenographic staff. They were given a place of honor, as I say, at the services, at the personal direction of Mrs. Roosevelt. And as we sat there, then suddenly in walked Mr. and Mrs. Edward Flynn, the New York Democratic leader. Mr. Flynn was looking very solemn, but his heels clicked quite loudly as he walked over the wooden floors of the East Room, that is, the edge along the walls where there was no rug. And Donald Nelson and his wife were sitting there. Donald Nelson looking very somber, sober, looking straight ahead, speaking to no one. fact, the only time that the quiet of the room was broken was when someone entered the room as it neared the hour for the time for the services to begin. I also noticed that Commander Bruin, the Navy doctor, who was with the president, I believe, when he died, was among those present. And finally, Perry Hopkins came in with Mrs. Hopkins. They were almost the last to enter. Mr. Hopkins looked unwell. He is, as you know, at the Mayo Hospital, and I believe expects to go back there. And then finally, at exactly 3:57, just 3 minutes before the services were to begin, the President of the United States entered with his wife and his daughter, Margaret. In fact, they entered so quickly, they walked down the aisle so fast and took their seats in the front aisle so quickly and so quietly that no one rose as they entered. And I remarked to Carlton Smith that I think that was the first time that I had ever witnessed the entrance of the President of the United States into any room at which those present in the room did not rise. I'm sure it was, of course, due to the fact that they had entered so simply and so quickly and had taken their seats before anyone realized they were there. The president was dressed in a dark blue double-breasted suit. His gray hair was plainly visible to me as I looked at him over the shoulder of those in front of me. He looked straight ahead at the casket. He seemingly never took his eyes from it. Mrs. Truman was dressed in black, a black coat. She wore no veil. And so was their daughter, Miss Margaret. The only person with them as they entered was the new president, a new military, Colonel Harry Vaughan. And then with punctuality, which has marked the entire White House career of Mrs. Roosevelt, 1/2 minute before 4 o'clock, as a matter of fact, Mrs. Roosevelt entered the East Room. She entered alone. She was a very lonely figure as she came into the East Room. And she walked quickly and stalwartly down the aisle, took her seat at the end, and she was immediately followed by her daughter Anna, by Anna Roosevelt's husband, Boddicker, Anna Roosevelt Boddicker, and her husband, and by her son, Elliot Roosevelt, General Elliot Roosevelt, a brigadier general now, and by her 4 daughters-in-law. They were all dressed in black. The young Mrs. Roosevelt were dressed very smartly, but exceedingly simply, without any accents to relieve their black funeral dresses, except that I believe one or two of them had on a little clip or something of that sort in their hat. Mrs. Roosevelt herself had no adornment at all. She was dressed completely in black, a black, simple black dress without any white accents or any jewelry or anything of that kind. She had on a simple black hat with a veil, but the veil was thrown back fully from her face and fell over, slightly over her, the nape of her neck and down her back slightly. It wasn't much of a veil. As a matter of fact, it was a rather simple veil, but it was one which she could put down over her face if she so chose, but she did not do so during any part of the ceremony. And then a rather novel thing happened, and rather unusual. It was a nice thing. Immediately after Mrs. Roosevelt had seated herself, a little clock that they have in the green room hit the chimes of 4 o'clock. And the chimes, they could be heard very plainly all through the East Room, but they were very light. They were quick, smartly struck chimes. You scarcely felt that they were being struck, but they were a very unusually nice manner to start the services, because they were quiet and simple, but nevertheless gave this note of formal beginning to the services. Now, for a description of the services themselves, I'm going to turn you back to Carlton Smith.
The funeral of Franklin D. Roosevelt opened with his favorite hymn, "Eternal Father Strong to Save." Announced by Right Reverend Angus Dunn, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, who said, "It is particularly asked that you all join him." All four verses were sung. Then Bishop Dunn read a quotation from Scripture. "I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die." Following this reading, Reverend John G. McGee, pastor of St. John's Church, known as the Church of the Presidents, read the 46th Psalm, which begins, "God is our hope and strength, a very present help in trouble." And that was followed by the 121st Psalm, "I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills from whence cometh my help." At the conclusion of the reading of the Psalms, the congregation was seated, and the Reverend Howard S. Wilkinson, rector of St. Thomas's Church, of which the president was a member and at one time a vestryman, read the lesson from the Scriptures. He had chosen the 8th chapter of the Romans, beginning at the 14th verse and continuing through the 19th verse. Known to all, it begins, "As many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God," and so forth. Then he read the lesson from St. John's Gospel, 14th chapter, 1st through 6th verses. Jesus said, "Let not your heart be troubled. Ye believe in God, believe also in me." Following the reading of the Gospel was another hymn, another of the president's favorites, the familiar "Faith of Our Fathers," and all four verses were sung. With conclusion of the hymn, the group stood for the versicle and the prayers. Bishop Dunn said them, beginning with a traditional Episcopalian prayer, "O God of peace, who has taught us that in returning and rest we shall be saved, in quietness and in confidence shall be our strength." Then the bishop said a special prayer, one he had written for the president's funeral. It goes, "O God, from whom every good gift cometh, we thank thee for the qualities of heart and mind which this thy servant brought to the service of our nation and our world, for steadfast courage in adversity, for clear vision of dangers to which many shut their eyes, for sympathy with the hungers and fears of common men, for trials met without surrender and weakness endured without defeat, for unyielding faith in the possibility of a more just and ordered world, delivered from the ancient curse of war, we praise thee, O God. And as we give thanks for his life and pray for thy merciful judgment on the imperfections which he and all of us have brought to our many callings, we beseech thee to take under thy good providence the lives and causes for which he spent himself. Grant quietness of heart and comfort and the assurance of thy eternal love to those whose lives were knit to his in the bonds of family and of friendship. Strengthen those on whom have fallen new responsibilities in the high tasks of government, that with simplicity of heart and sure trust in thee, they may accept as from thee the burden laid upon them. Watch over the men and women of our forces by sea, by land, and in the air, in particular those of this household. Be thou their strength when they are set in the midst of so many and great dangers, and grant that whether by life or by death, they may win for the whole world the fruits of their sacrifice and a righteous peace. Quicken and knit together in common loyalty the wills of this whole people, that we may resolutely take to ourselves the responsibility bequeathed to us by our stricken leader. Keep us in this land and those peoples who struggle at our side steadfast and united in the unfinished task of war. Revive us when in weariness we are tempted to grow slack and each man to seek first his own advantage. As we look ahead to final victory, enable us to strive even more mightily, in peace and in war, to bring new freedom and dignity to every member of our human race, and to bear without stint our destined responsibilities in the family of nations. Make ready our shoulders to carry the burdens of victory, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to free the oppressed, and to lay the foundation for a more just and ordered common life for all thy people." At this point, Bishop Dunn recalled the statement from the president's first inaugural address that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And he continued, as it was his first statement in public life, so he would wish it to be his last. The funeral was concluded with a traditional Episcopalian benediction. The God of peace, who brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus Christ, the great shepherd of the sheep, make you perfect in every good work to do his will, working in you that which is well-pleasing in his sight. Through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen. And so, quietly, as it had begun, the funeral of Franklin D. Roosevelt was at an end at 4:25 in the East Room of the White House.
Just before we sign off, I might give you one or more impressions here and a few notes that I jotted down as I sat there watching the ceremony. I looked especially at the president, the new president of the United States. And I noticed that he looked, throughout the ceremony, he looked straight ahead. He never lifted his eyes from the casket, except occasionally, rarely, when he looked up at the minister who was praying. I wondered what his thoughts might have been. And then, as the ceremony went on, although it was, I believe, as Carlton said, only 25 minutes or so long, it grew quite warm in the East Room, and some women had been fortunate enough to carry fans with them, brought out fans and fanned themselves. I noticed that some of the men dotted their foreheads with their handkerchief. Both the president and Mrs. Roosevelt joined in the singing of the hymns and sang them fully and wholeheartedly. There wasn't any holding back on the part of either one of them. And I think that Mrs. Truman also was singing, the hymn. And so came to the closing ceremony. As I said before, it was marked by its utter simplicity, a simplicity which was certainly befitting both a great man and a great country.
We return you to the networks. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.